couple of previous presentations, and I know that there are some folks here that weren't here for the previous presentations. So my apologies to that degree. Hopefully it stands alone well enough. But let me just recap two basic ideas from the previous presentations. How's that? I'm just going to ad-lib this. I've been talking about what sometimes is known as gospel medical missionary work or gospel medical missionary evangelism. And probably the unique element of that is simply that, one expression of it is that the union of Christ-like ministry to the soul and Christ-like ministry to the body is the true interpretation of the gospel. That's what Jesus did. Jesus spent more time healing than he did preaching, we're told. And so gospel medical missionary work is our work of carrying on Jesus' work, okay? In another place, the comment is made that we are given a ministry identical to the ministry of Christ. We're really just here to get his job done. It's not like it's a different thing. So that's one element. And then one other aspect that we talked about on previous occasion is very much related to that, and that is the concept that Paul refers to as the lie of Satan. Those who do not have a love for the truth, the Bible says that they will be sent strong delusion, that they will believe the lie. King James says a lie, but Greek is actually the lie, the specific lie. And that specific lie is that the universe will be a better place if we all would just look out for ourselves. God says that the universe will be a great place if we all forget ourselves and take care of the next guy over. And Lucifer came along and he said, you know, I've got a different plan. I think this will work just maybe even a little bit better because right now God's not taking care of me the way I really think he ought to. And so I will just take care of myself and that will solve the problem. Well, it actually didn't solve any problems. It created them all. So that is the lie. All these presentations come from a series that would be known as this here. And just one last brief explanation to tie things in previously. The root word, the Greek root sozo, you see the latter portion of that up there. The Greek root sozo is the word that the New Testament uses for both physical healing, as in, go in peace, your faith has made you well. That made you well is sozo. And also for spiritual salvation, as in, you shall call him Jesus, for he shall save his people from their sins. Save is sozo. So the point is that healing and salvation are actually the same thing. They are so closely related, they should never be separated, we're told. And in fact, in one place, we're told that when we do separate them, it results in the worst evil being placed upon the churches. Okay, so that's kind of the background. And so now we move on to this particular presentation. I call this one insanity. The convincing evidence. Normally we have a fairly negative point of, you know, reference when it comes to insanity. It's not, we don't usually hold that up as a great virtue. You know, there's always the old saying is, you know, you don't have to be insane to work here, but sometimes it helps. You know, probably you've worked in a place like that at some point. I think we all have, but anyhow. So nonetheless, that's what we're talking about here. So let's go on, and hopefully this will become acceptably clear later on. And now again, I'm picking up some threads from some previous presentations from our denominational history. And the first person we want to mention right now was actually a very famous guy by the name of Dr. John Harvey Kellogg. Now, if you've not heard of Dr. Kellogg and you just hear the name Kellogg, you might be thinking cornflakes. And that would not be all wrong. He is the guy who invented cornflakes. He also invented granola, my personal staff of life, and peanut butter. You know, you'd think George Washington Carver would have, I mean, he did everything else with peanuts, but somehow he never got around to peanut butter. I don't quite understand that one, but it was Dr. Kellogg that had his fingers in all those things. He was not that bent on doing food manufacture, however, so he turned it over to his younger brother, William Keith Kellogg, and that's why, you know, some of you may be old enough to remember, but you know, years ago it always used to be, you know, Kellogg's cornflakes, the original has this signature. Do you remember that? Anybody remember that? W.K. Kellogg right there on the cereal box. Well, Dr. Kellogg was busy doing other things, however. And for summation of what we've got here just the moment anyhow, let's just say that he was heavily involved with the church, the Seventh-day Adventist Church, from, well, his youth, actually, in the 1860s, all the way up. Eventually, he left here. His connection with the church was ended in 1907. For our sake, we're interested primarily in his role from 1888 on after that. And from 1888, and I'm just mentioning this without giving any of the history of this again, but we've done that before. From 1888 up until, say, 1897, at least, give or take, Dr. Kellogg was a very helpful fellow in the church. He did a great many really good things. He was human. He made his mistakes along the way, but he was doing a lot of really good stuff during that time period, say 88 to 97. But unfortunately, during that time period, there were others, most notably some, not all, but some Seventh-day Adventist ministers who didn't like Kellogg for a variety of reasons, made his life miserable, made his work hard, and by about 1897, he kind of got fed up with it. And he just said, you know, these stupid ministers, I'm going to write them all off. I'll do my own thing. And that's where things started going downhill. Seriously, okay? So that's kind of what we're picking up there. We have looked previously at his positive contributions. Now, I want to jump down to about, maybe a date on this statement, but probably sometime about 1903 at least, maybe up to 05 or 06. I'm not sure exactly. But here we go. Oh, let's see. I'm sorry. Is there anything else I need to say here? I don't think so. Okay. A scene has been presented before me of actions performed by you, and that would be Dr. Kellogg we're looking at here, similar to the actions of Satan in the heavenly courts. From time to time, I have given warnings to different ones who are being blinded by your sophistries and misrepresentations. Your power of misrepresentation is so continuously exerted that many have been deceived. In some things, you act like a man bereft of his reason. It is a marvel to me how one who has had the light in so many ways, who has received so many warnings and reproofs, can yet go on blindfolding himself and others. Okay, well, obviously this is not a positive commendation for the good doctor. During the latter years of his association with the church, he became a very negative influence. That's unfortunate. It's kind of a classic situation where anything that is powerful for good can also be powerful for evil. So, let's go on. Another statement, similar. You have been the spokesman, repeating the words of accusation and condemnation of the arch-deceiver. Your science has been used to benumb the sensibilities and confuse the judgment of others. In long night talks. You have presented your mind and plans and works, and these have become their mind and plan and works. In listening to your words, these men have imbibed the very science of the tempter. You have twisted and manipulated and misstated and misrepresented the testimonies that God has given, making them of none effect. This whole matter has been presented to me. You have worked as Lucifer worked, and that's the key thought we're coming to in all this. You have worked as Lucifer worked in the heavenly courts to persuade his associates to unite with him. The enemy has used his arts upon your mind, your boasted study of science, and your assertion that you had obtained something excellent have deceived the men connected with you, and they have refused to listen to the warning sent to keep them from listening to your false representations. Now, the key thing that I'm after here, and this is what frankly attracted me or drew my attention to this particular phase of history, was this idea of working as Lucifer worked. This sort of a statement comes up about Dr. Kellogg several times, and so I was intrigued by that. And I said, okay, what's that all about? Is there anything really important there? The ministers of God are being drawn in and deceived by his science, that would be Dr. Kellogg. He is doing all in his power to create a division between the medical work and the ministry of the word. Now, remember earlier on, the worst evil, when the medical work and the evangelistic work is separated, when we don't follow the pattern of Jesus, essentially is what that means, when they are separated, it creates the worst evil. And so, obviously, we've got a problem here when somebody is trying to create a division between these two branches of work. That's an issue. Okay. Okay, let's just go on. Here's the statement. When the gospel ministers and the medical missionary workers are not united, there is placed on our churches the worst evil that can be placed there. Now, we talked about that previously, so I'm not going to go into that too much more. There was a comment a slide or two back about Dr. Kellogg working the same way that Lucifer worked in heaven. Okay, and that's what I want to go back to. The basic story, biblically, the basic story of Lucifer working in heaven comes from Revelation chapter 12. Another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great fiery red dragon having 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 diadems on his head. His tail drew a third of the stars of heaven and threw them to the earth. Now, when you get into the symbolism of the book of Revelation, the stars represent the angels. So this is Satan, the great serpent, it says elsewhere in the chapter. And he drew a third of the angels. And war broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought with the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought, but they did not prevail, nor was a place found for them in heaven any longer. So the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. Okay, how did Lucifer deceive 33% of the angels? I mean, come on, they're not dumb. You know, I don't really know what angelic IQ ranges run in, but I'm guessing it's more than we have. How were they ever deceived? What was he doing? And what was it that Dr. Kellogg was doing that was like what Lucifer did? That was intriguing to me. Well, here are some comments on that. Lucifer gained the sympathy of some of his associates by suggesting thoughts of criticism regarding the government of God. Okay, so stop there for just a second. So Lucifer was the highest of the angels, okay? So that gave him a lot of position and clout, so to speak, you know? You know the feeling probably when, you know, the guy two levels up in management comes walking through your department, wherever you work, if you're a teacher, it's the feeling you get when the principal walks into your classroom to see what's going on. Okay, that's interesting. The boss is down in the in whatever department you in or you work in or whatever it is. There's always somebody that's a step or two up. Some government inspector or something, maybe. There's always somebody, you know. So Lucifer had that kind of clout, and he could go around, and he would suggest thoughts of criticism. Now, I'm guessing that suggest was very, very subtle. Because again, we're talking about angels. You know, they're not dumb. So he suggests this, but then notice what happens next. This evil seed was scattered, and in a most seducing manner, and after it had sprung up and taken root in the minds of many, he, that's Lucifer, gathered the ideas that he himself had first implanted in the minds of others and brought them before the highest order of angels as the thoughts of other minds against the government of God. Thus, by ingenious methods of his own devising, Lucifer introduced rebellion in heaven. Okay, so how's this work? I'm trying to breathe life into something that I don't fully understand, obviously, but okay, Lucifer's the top guy. He goes down to maybe, I don't know what the social structure of angels is. They're not all just carbon copy cookie cutter, So somehow or the other, he went to some of them that are not the highest order. So he went to the rank and file angels. I don't know. Planted some seeds of doubt, let it kind of fester for a little while, came back around, and any time he heard a little echo, just a little echo of what he had implanted in their thinking, he'd make a little note of this, okay? And then he goes back up to the highest order. And eventually he goes to God himself. And he says, this is what the angels are saying, man. They're not happy down there. You're kind of sitting up here, in Washington, D.C. You don't know what it's like out there on Main Street, USA type of thing. That's that kind of approach. Okay, let's go on. By sly insinuations, Lucifer sowed the seeds of doubt in the minds of many of the angels, and when he had won their support, he carried the matter to God, declaring that it was the sentiment of many of the heavenly beings that he, Lucifer, should have the preference to Christ. God, here's the deal. See, everybody out here, they really think that I should be, like one up instead of him. Okay? So all sorts of fascinating things in there, and we're not going to go into trying to figure that out right now. But anyhow, Lucifer had presented the purpose of God in a false light, misconstruing and distorting them to excite dissent and dissatisfaction. He cunningly drew his hearers on to give utterance to their feelings. This was foreign stuff. The angels were perfectly happy with the government of God. They were perfectly happy with their role and their position and their rank. That wasn't bothering anybody till Lucifer came along and planted these little seeds. And then he cunningly drew his hearers on to give utterance to their feelings. Then these expressions were repeated by him when it would serve his purpose and evidence that the angels were not fully in harmony with the government of God. Interesting. If I were going to try and summarize that, I would say that Lucifer first corrupted the thinking of the angels, and then he co-opted their influence. He took the quote, this angel said this, and this angel said this, and this angel said this. You got to look at this, highest angels. You got to look at what they're saying out there. This is what he said, this is what he said, this is what he said. And these angels over here who had never had a sinful thought in their life and probably didn't even really understand or really believe what they were saying, they were cunningly drawn forth, and now Lucifer's using their influence to support his position. I think you could find some examples of that if you went looking at local politics or national politics or international politics, but we won't go there. So that led me to looking to influence. I want to understand influence, because influence is what makes things happen. Influence is what carries the day in God's work. Influence is what Lucifer brought against the government of heaven. Influence, how's this all go? Okay, so let's move on. To a large degree, Satan has succeeded in the execution of his plans through the medium of influence. Taking advantage of the action of mind on mind, he prevailed on Adam to sin. Thus, at its very source, human nature was corrupted. And ever since then, sin has continued its hateful work, reaching from mind to mind. Every sin committed awakens the echoes of the original sin. This is influence, mind to mind. What's my influence on you? What's your influence on the next guy? This is important stuff. Mutual dependence, that's a kind of a synonym for this influence idea. Mutual dependence is a wonderful thing. Wonderful as in amazing, not necessarily always good, but you know. Reciprocal influence should be carefully studied. We should find out without doubt on what side we are exerting our influence. When placed on the side of right, influence is a power for God. When placed on the side of evil, it's a power for Satan. One human being under Satan's control becomes a means of temptation to another human being. Thus, evil grows into immense proportions. Influence. How striking is the power of influence as here presented, and how necessary it is for each of us to know the character of our influence. When that first sin could bring such a flood of woe upon our world, not an evil deed has been performed, but an unseen witness has marked it and followed its influence from one person to another, and a faithful record has been made of it. You know, we can... Somehow, it's like we take Adam and Eve's sin and we put it into a magical category of its own. But you know what? I mean, 3 weeks later, probably one of them sinned again, and that sin has exerted an influence too. And then Cain kills Abel, and that sin exerted an influence too. And every stupid, evil thing that I've ever done has exerted an influence too. The influence of mind on mind, so strong a power for good when sanctified, is equally strong for evil in the hands of those opposed to God. This power Satan used in his work of instilling evil into the minds of the angels. Cast out of heaven, Satan set up his kingdom in this world, and ever since he has been untiringly striving to seduce human beings from their allegiance to God. He uses the same power that he used in heaven, the influence of mind on mind. Men become tempters of their fellow men. The plan of God, the plan of God was that the highest influence in the universe, important, the highest influence in the universe emanating from the center of all power, capital C, obvious reference to deity, right, should be brought to bear on human minds. The goodness and love of God subdues the heart, and then man becomes a channel to communicate these divine impressions to his fellow men. Thus in Christ he is a fruit-bearing branch. No man, saint or sinner, liveth to himself. The highest influence in the universe is to come to human minds, and then our job is to pass that on to the next guy. That's how we carry forward the Lord's work, is carrying on the influence that Jesus came to exert on us. Well, what is an evil influence? I'm not sure this is my final developed thought, but here's my best definition at the moment. An evil influence, this is just simply my words, don't take it for anything more than that. An evil influence is any statement or action that leads others to believe they can benefit by pursuing their own interest to the neglect of others, and that such a course is commendable. In other words, an evil influence is anything that encourages someone else to believe the lie. Does that make sense? The lie is the root of the whole sin issue. So anything I say, anything I do, or anything I don't say, or anything I don't say or do when I should have said or should have done, you understand all that, okay, that encourages someone else in that direction, that's an evil influence. And it's all around us. You know, every time someone lies or steals or murders and gets away with it to our observation of things, you know, that's a vote in favor of lying and stealing and murder. You know, and sometimes we turn these people into pop counterculture heroes type of thing, you know? And then we make movies about them. Oh, yeah, man, you see what that guy did, you know? That's an evil influence. Our society is full of evil influences. Just about everything you're going to run into on TV and the internet is evil in one degree or another. There are exceptions. Praise the Lord for exceptions. Okay. So, here's the question, though. There's no doubt that there are evil influences abroad in the land. The question is, what do you do about it? What can we do about it? Well, what you have to do with an evil influence is counteract it. It's almost Newtonian physics. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. You remember that whole thing, okay? If there's an evil influence, it has to be counteracted. How? Well, there's only one way that you can counteract an evil influence, and that is an opposite force. If something's moving west and you want to stop it, you have to exert an equivalent force east. It's just physics. Okay. Well, I think I must have hit. Sorry about that. I'm smacking my hand around. Okay. So how do you counter an evil influence? How do you know when you've done the job anyhow? Okay. Well, that's enough. That's simple enough. An evil influence is counteracted only when there's been enough counteracting influence to destroy the believability of the false influence in the first place. As long as someone still believes that lying or stealing or murder is a fine thing to do, you haven't counteracted it. You need more press back, okay? Let's see, consider this Bible reference here. God also has highly exalted Jesus, that would be, and given him the name which is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow, of those in heaven and of those on earth and of those under the earth, and that every tongue should confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. How many? Everybody. We're talking 100%. Not just of current population, not just Christians, not just current world population. We're talking 100%, not even of just the cumulative population of the world through all ages. We're talking about every sentient, living, intelligent being that's ever existed in the universe. That's a big order. How are you going to counter the evil influence on that scale? God is not going to win this thing with 51% or 75% or 95%. He's going to win this thing when every tongue confesses, when every knee shall bow. What's the influence that's going to accomplish that? There is one other issue, and we kind of touched on this earlier. In debate, if you study debate or study formal logic, there's this cute little thing called poisoning the well. It's a logical fallacy. It's called poisoning the well. And all it is say I'm in a debate and I'm running for governor and this guy's running for governor, And I get up, and the first thing I say is, ladies and gentlemen, I got to warn you, this guy lies. That's poisoning the well. What's he supposed to do now? You know, he stands up and he says whatever it is he has to say, and everybody out in the audience is going, I don't know, he might be lying to me. Poisoning the well is just simply the accusation that the other guy lies. So, you know, let's turn it around. The other guy told everybody that I lie. Now what am I supposed to do? Ladies and gentlemen, I don't lie. And they're thinking, oh yeah, sure, maybe you don't lie. You know, it's kind of like some of the older ones here will remember, you know, your president is not a crook. Remember that line? Okay. Sure. Oh, yeah, we believe that. Well, maybe we did, you know, until we found out he was a crook and a liar. So the point is, you can't say, I don't lie. I mean, you can say it. It doesn't do anything. Because they're all thinking, and if you do lie, that's probably one of them. Hey, you know. So you can't ever proclaim your way out of this accusation. You have to demonstrate it. And I need to hurry up. So let's go on. God has to show what's going on. To the intent that now the manifold wisdom of God might be made known, that's the demonstration right there, by the church to the principalities and powers of the heavenly places. This is our job. This is your job. We are the ones who are supposed to make the demonstration or be used by God to make the demonstration that answers the question, is God lying? Is he really selfish? Lucifer says he is. He says, I'm not selfish. I love everybody. And Lucifer says, oh, yeah, you believe that. Sure. This is how it's supposed to be done. This is the answer right here. Okay. Moving on. How can human beings ever do anything that is so educational that the principalities and powers of the heavenly universe can learn something new? I mean, really? We're smarter than they are, or what? You know? Well, here's the answer to that. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, wholly acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. We don't have to be geniuses. We're not proving that human beings are smart. We're proving what God's will is. We're proving that God's will is good and perfect and acceptable. Well, that's because God has a law. Lucifer doesn't like it. The Bible, of course, says it's a good thing. Old Testament says the same thing as well. It is our obedience, the obedience of the church, which is to provide the demonstration. And let's skip over that and let's move on. The law of God is the foundation of his government and is exactly what is needed to preserve life and righteousness. This is why it's so important, okay? Because without God's law, everybody dies. Everybody goes unrighteous, and unrighteousness results in death, okay? It's exactly what is needed. It's not anything more than what's needed. It's not like he says, well, I'll just throw in a few extras here. No. Anything less than the law of God is evil. And evil results in death. That's why Jesus said that Lucifer, Satan, was a murderer from the beginning and does not stand in the truth because there is no truth in him. When he speaks a lie, he speaks from his own resources, for he is a liar and the father of it. Lucifer was a murderer from the beginning, it says. I'm going to skip some things I'd be tempted to go into there. Let's move on. The standard of the golden rule is the true standard of Christianity. Anything short of it is a deception. There is no silver rule. You know, no silver, no bronze rule, you know. It goes all the way actually from gold to wood, hay, and stubble. You know, it's just kind of like one big jump right there, okay? A religion that would lead us to be careless of human needs, sufferings, or rights is a spurious religion. In slighting the claims of the poor, the suffering, and the sinful, we are proving ourselves traitors to Christ. Now we're back to gospel medical missionary work. We cannot ignore these people, or we violate the golden rule. Search heaven and earth, and there is no truth revealed more powerful than that which is made manifest in works of mercy to those who need our sympathy and aid. This is the truth, as it is in Jesus. When those who profess the name of Christ shall practice the principles of the golden rule, the same power will attend the gospel as in apostolic times. It's pretty clear. Well, we've got a lot of pieces on the table. It's kind of like a jigsaw puzzle when you just dump the box out. Now we get to try and put them together. And this actually is where the whole insanity thing comes in. Think of Jesus in his public ministry. We're picking up at a point now where he's spent 3.5 years in his public ministry, demonstrating, teaching, showing in every way possible selfless love. That's what he's doing. He's been demonstrating, and just everything he could do is self-sacrificing love. This is the influence he came from heaven to exert, the highest of influence in the universe, is the influence of self-sacrificing love. And he's been doing this for 3.5 years. It's now Thursday afternoon, and he and his disciples are sitting down at what we call the Last Supper. What were the disciples thinking about at that point? Well, I think it's Luke. Yes, Luke tells us. Now, there was also a dispute among them as to which of them should be considered the greatest. That's what they were thinking about when they sat down at the Last Supper. 3.5 years? And the disciples have not even made it to first base. They are thinking about exactly what Lucifer was thinking about when he started sin in the first place. Who's going to be greatest around here? 3.5 years, and they are solidly on the side of the enemy. Now, by all accounts, that would make Jesus a failure. I mean, come on. 3.5 years, and this is what you've accomplished. Nice try. It's worse than that. Not only was he a failure, he was hopelessly insane. And I say that somewhat guardedly. You've heard the little statement. I think it's fairly recent. I don't remember hearing it maybe about the last 3 years or so. It's kind of cute, and generally I think I like it. The definition of insanity is doing the same thing again and hoping for a different result. So for 3.5 years, Jesus has been demonstrating self-sacrificing love. It's Thursday afternoon. It's the Last Supper. He's going to be dead within 20-some hours. And he says, I'm going to try one more day. I'm going to try it one more day. I'm going to do exactly the same thing I've always done. I'm going to demonstrate self-sacrificing love for one more day, and we'll see if it works. Well, that's insanity. Or perhaps it's maybe the most stunning example of confidence in the divine plan of government that has ever been demonstrated. I mean, this is like, you know, we for those of you who enjoy politics and brinkmanship diplomacy, you know, John Kennedy, you know, facing down the Russians there on the Cuban Missile Crisis, you know, they went nose to nose and the other guy blinked. This is nose to nose. And Jesus says, I'm going to do it one more day. I'm not backing down. I know that I'm right. I know that the principles are true. I know this is the way things really work. That's gutsy. I admire courage. To me, this is stunning. What Jesus did in the next 24 hours, if we wanted to get analytical about it, qualitatively, it was exactly the same as he's always done. He demonstrated self-sacrificing love. There was one difference. Quantitatively, he blew the lid off all the charts. What he did in the next 24 hours will, for all eternity, be the very definition of self-sacrificing love. He was into this thing completely. You know the story. He finished his meal with the disciples and they headed off to Gethsemane. He was betrayed, he was denied, he was beaten, he was crucified. He prayed, Father, forgive them, they know not what they do. He felt dejected, rejected, condemned of God, and yet again, in a stunning example of confidence, he said, Father, into thy hands I commit my spirit. I know what you're like, no matter what it looks like. The Lord Jesus has bound up his interests with the interests of the whole world. His influence is an ever-widening, shoreless influence. Although unseen, it is intensely active, wielded by the Father himself. It is the element which is used in restoring the moral image of God in man. Self-sacrificing love is the influence of all influences. Ignore it at our peril. This is what makes things happen, good things happen. So how are we supposed to do this? How are we supposed to exert this influence on the world? It looks pretty hopeless. The world hardly even notices us, and when they do, it's usually with a snicker. I mean, Christians in general would probably fall into that category, Adventists maybe in particular. You know, when God says, fear God and give glory to Him, people yawn. When we tell them about the mark of the beast, you know, it's really not nearly as scary as the latest Hollywood horror flick. Come on. We don't have cool sound effects and special, you know, graphics, you know, computer graphics. We're just talking, and, you know, we're reading Revelation 14. That's going to make an impression when they've just got done watching whatever it is. I don't know what's the current horror flick rage, but, you know, zombies, I think. I don't know. I'm not into that. But, you know, okay. You know, that's what we've got to compete with. How's that going to work? Well, Isaiah 58, Gospel Medical Mission Work, is the work God requires his people to do. With the work of advocating the commandments of God and repairing the breach that has been made in the law of God, we are to mingle compassion for suffering humanity. We are to show supreme love to God, and we are to exalt his memorial, that's the Sabbath, which has been trodden down by unholy feet, and with this we are to manifest mercy, benevolence, and the tenderest pity for the fallen race. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. As a people, we must take hold of this work. Love revealed for suffering humanity gives significance and power to the truth. Notice this. How are we going to compete with Hollywood and everything else? There it is. Do we need power? Do we need significance? Do we want influence? There it is. It's the only way it happens. Jesus himself gave us the key on this. A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another as I have loved you, that you also love one another. By this all will know that you are my disciples, if you have love one for another. What? If you have, yeah, love one for another. Okay. That's, there it is. That's a big issue, actually. It's simple, but it's a big issue. A couple quick examples. I'm sorry, I'm running long. Notice this. Nothing will help us more at this stage of our work than to understand and fulfill the mission of the greatest medical missionary that ever trod the earth. Nothing will help us more than to realize how sacred is this kind of work and how perfectly it corresponds with the life work of the great missionary. The object of our mission is the same as the object of Christ's mission. Why did God send his son to the fallen world? To make known and to demonstrate to mankind his love for them. Okay, notice this. Nothing will help us more. Nothing will help us more. You know, do we want to move up to the big guns? Do we want to exert some influence? Nothing will help us more than to get to learn. I don't know how to do this. I'm reading this stuff, and it's easy to talk about. I don't know how to do this. Medical missionary work. It's where it's at. God's purpose in committing to men and women the mission that he committed to Christ is to disentangle his followers from all worldly policy and to give them a work identical with the work that Christ did. That's our job. We're to manifest self-sacrificing love, and we're to do it in roughly the same way. Now, we're not going to be, you know, so much doing miracles type of thing. There's a whole story on that. We covered that before. Okay, how are we ever going to do that? Jesus was the Son of God. I mean, I'm not the Son of God. I can't do exactly what he did. So how do we do this? Two quick examples from his early disciples. Start with Peter and John. Now, Peter and John went up together to the temple at the hour of prayer, the ninth hour. And a certain man lame from his mother's womb was carried, whom they laid daily at the gate of the temple, which is called Beautiful, to ask alms from those who entered the temple, who, seeing Peter and John about to go into the temple, asked for alms. And fixing his eyes on him with John, Peter said, "Look at us." So he gave them his attention, expecting to receive something from them. Then Peter said, "Silver and gold I do not have, but what I do have, I give you. In the name of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, rise up and walk." And he took him by the right hand and lifted him up, and immediately his feet and ankle bones received strength. So he, leaping up, stood and walked and entered the temple with them, walking, leaping, and praising God. You probably know the story. They even made a song out of this, right? Peter and John didn't have any silver or gold. It's not hard to understand. I mean, these guys were fishermen, and we know it had been 40-some days since they went fishing last time, and when they did, they left a big catch on the beach. So, yeah, they're broke. that's not hard to understand, okay? But here's the thing. They weren't worried about their financial condition. They were on their way to the temple, not to the lake. And their financial condition didn't stop them from helping the other guy. Actually, there are some really good things to be said about poverty. There's some bad things too, don't get me wrong. But there are some good things to be said about poverty. Notice this statement. This is an interesting comment that Ellen White made. "We believed the warning that Christ was soon to come, and we felt such an earnest longing for those in sin that we were willing to make almost any sacrifice. We have known what poverty is, and it was the best experience of our lives." Really? That seems a little strange. There is one very good thing about poverty. The highest and most precious of all human experiences is the constant dependence of the soul upon God. Now, I think that embraces a whole lot more than money. But for some of us, we're so dumb that the only thing we can really relate to is money. You know, it's a real basic thing. And maybe that's a good place starting for some of us. There is a special influence that comes from someone who has little to nothing himself, who nevertheless is so confident in the Lord's care that he willingly goes out of his way to help the next guy over. That's a powerful influence. "Silver and gold, I don't have any, man. I don't have anything, but I can still help you." That's impressive. As we bring ourselves into right relationship with God, we shall have success wherever we go. You know, I'm still working on that. I don't always always have success wherever I go, okay? I know what that tells me. I'm not there. I'm working on that. And it is success that we want, not money. Living success. And God will give it to us because he knows all about our self-denial. He knows every sacrifice that we make. You may think that your self-denial does not make any difference, that you ought to have more consideration and so on, but it makes a great difference with the Lord. When individuals begin to reach out after higher and still higher wages, something comes into their experience that places them where they stand no longer on vantage ground. But when they take the wage that carries on the face of it, the fact that they are self-sacrificed, the Lord sees their self-denial and he gives them success and victory. The Lord that sees in secret will reward openly for every sacrifice that his tried servants have been willing to make. There is a power in poverty. Believe it or not, there's a power of influence there. It's not the only one. There are other ways of doing the same thing, and maybe even more impressive ones. Hang on, I have one more. Second example comes from the life of a guy by the name of Nicodemus. Nicodemus was on like the other end of the socioeconomic spectrum, shall we say, from silver and gold have I none. Yeah, he had silver and gold. He had lots of silver and gold. He was rich. He was a member of the Sanhedrin. He was respected. He was everything that these other guys weren't, okay? He was also a follower of Jesus, sort of, kind of. And he used his power and his influence to protect Jesus. He did everything he could. He did everything that money and power and influence could do, and it wasn't enough to stop the Messiah from being crucified. Probably that's the first time in years that Nicodemus had actually felt helpless. He tried to keep this guy from being killed. He used everything he had, and they killed him anyhow. But then, through the influence of that death, that final self-sacrificing death, Nicodemus did the one thing he hadn't done before, and that is he went public. He threw all caution to the winds, and he and Joseph of Arimathea went through the proper channels and secured possession of the body of Christ and gave him a burial fit for a king. Annas and Caiaphas must have been, their heads were spinning. I mean, this guy was buried like he was royalty. That wasn't good. They wanted this guy forgotten. And, you know, along comes Joseph and Nicodemus, and they go and do this. But more than this, Nicodemus, we are told, employed his wealth in sustaining the infant church so that the Jews had expected to be blotted out at the death of Christ. In the time of peril, he who had been so cautious and questioning was firm as a rock, encouraging the faith of the disciples and furnishing means, that's money, to carry forward the work of the gospel. Who do you think paid Thomas's ticket to India? You know? How do you think these guys got around? It was the money of Joseph and Nicodemus. He was scorned and persecuted by those who had paid him reverence in other days. He became poor in this world's goods. Yet he faltered not in the faith which had its beginning in that night conference with Jesus. You know, in the Mishnah, and I'm sorry, I need to hunt this up, and I'm probably going to mix it up just a little bit. If I remember it right, there is a comment made about Joseph and Nicodemus. And like I said, this may be, you know, don't quote me on this one because it may be a little out of whack. But as I recall it, the basic idea was that the combined wealth of those two men was enough to support everyone in the city of Jerusalem for 20 years. That's what these guys gave to the gospel. In no way could the Lord be better glorified and the truth more highly honored than for unbelievers to see that the truth has wrought a great and good work upon the lives of naturally covetous and penurious men. If it could be seen that the faith of such had an influence to mold their characters, to change them from close, selfish, overreaching, money-loving men to men who love to do good, who seek opportunities to use their means to bless those who need to be blessed, who visit the widow and fatherless in their affliction, and who keep themselves unspotted from the world, it would be an evidence that their religion was genuine. such would let their light so shine that others, seeing their good works, would be led to glorify their Father which is in heaven. This fruit would be unto holiness, and they would be living representatives of Christ upon the earth. Sinners would be convicted that there is in the truth a power to which they are strangers. This is a particular phase of what gospel medical missionary work is supposed to accomplish. Those guys that we're talking about, those close, money, overreaching, selfish money, whatever, those guys, they're the people down here in the business district of Wichita. We need to convert them. God's message will impress them. And when their money goes into God's work, other people are going to look and say, whoa, what happened to, what's his name, Coke? No, I don't know what the first name is. I'm not really on a first name basis with those guys. What happened? All of the Koch brothers' money just went into the gospel. Or somebody else, whoever it is. The joy of our Lord consisted in enduring toil and shame for others, that they might be benefited thereby. We are capable of being happy in following his example and living to bless our fellow men. We have the privilege of being just as insane as Jesus was. And really, what more can you ask for than to be insanely happy? You know? Doing the right thing and enjoying it. Following the example of Jesus. Our closing hymn is 330.